In reference to the deep divisions in our country at present, one writer notes, America cannot long go on like this. Something's got to give, and something will. Hello and welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and right now our guest is Michael Anton, who wrote those words. It's part of his new book called After the Flight 93 Election. It's a short book, but packs a powerful punch. He's a former Trump advisor and also a lecturer with Hillsdale College. Michael, it's great to have you on the program. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay, so you say that America is divided and something's got to give. What do you think's going to give?
Well, I don't know. You know, Yogi Berra famously said it's hard to make predictions, especially about the future.
Yeah.
I just think that, you know, what we're seeing right now is not long-term sustainable. And I'll lay my cards on the table and be blunt. I'm not an equal opportunity blamer. I'm not going to say that, you know, both sides are, you know, equally to blame. Maybe blame can be shared by both sides, but it seems to me the left, Trump's opposition, the resistance, is really driving this. They're driving a further and fundamental radicalization of American politics. I think the president has proposed some very reasonable things that the left says, you know, absolutely no to. You know, calling, for instance, when you have the Speaker of the House say the wall is an immorality. To have a border is an immorality. I mean, this is crazy talk, and it's crazy talk that's actually significantly crazier than the crazy talk of the left of just a few years ago. They get progressively more radical almost by the day. You don't have to go back very far to find elite, prominent Democrats speaking in favor of a wall, speaking in favor of border enforcement, speaking in favor of immigration reform. You only have to go back a few years to find that, and nowadays, it's the, you know, absolutely required on the left and in the Democratic Party to say that walls are evil and border enforcement is evil. I mean, that's a recent change.
Yeah.
And it just, it concerns me very much to see this radicalization process take place and accelerate.
Hmm. By the way, Nancy Pelosi herself has been on tape. I've heard it, little sound bites, just from, well, it was when Obama was the president. So I guess that's the difference. All right, what do you mean by the phrase, the Flight 93 election? What does that mean? Your book is called After the Flight 93 Election.
So I wrote an essay that became famous in September of 2016, before the Trump election, in which I used that analogy. I said this is the Flight 93 election, and, the Flight 93 is famously the airplane, the fourth hijacked airplane on September 11th, 2001, but the one that crashed in Pennsylvania and did not hit its target, which people believe is likely to have been the U.S. Capitol,
right,
or might have been the White House. I don't think that's ever been proven either way.
Well, in the movie, it was the Capitol. But anyway, go ahead.
and it crashed because the passengers wrested control of it. Now, nobody knows exactly what happened because everybody who was there died, clearly.
Right.
But it does seem also clear that the passengers wrested control of it from the hijackers and prevented it from reaching its target. So my analogy, admittedly somewhat provocative, was that a Democratic victory in 2016 would have essentially meant the end of America as a constitutional republic in the way that we had known it. And it's a long, kind of complex argument, but what the left and the progressive movement have been building over a century is something called the administrative state, which takes political control out of the hands of the electorate, out of the hands of the people, puts it in the hand of elites and unelected bureaucrats. And they've been very successful in building this edifice over the century. And I thought they had gotten, and I still believe they got quite close to making administrative state rule permanent. And it had, they won the 2016 election. They almost certainly would have then, with the advantages of incumbency, won the 2020 election. And by the time you get to 2024, the process would be, we'd be so far into the process that there wouldn't be any going back. So, and more specifically, I was angry and offended and bewildered by conservatives, people supposedly on my own side, who were denouncing Trump in terms I had never heard them use on any Democratic or far-left opponent, at least not in my lifetime. And here they were standing up against somebody who was standing for things that we as conservatives should want, a strong border, a more sensible foreign policy, an economic and trade policy that favors the American people, and it doesn't favor international and even domestic elites. And the conservatives just went crazy and attacked Trump or at least a portion of them, I would say a majority of them, in ways that I thought were unwise and really unconscionable in the end. And so the essay was fundamentally about calling them out for what I saw with their mistaken analysis and their really dangerous rhetoric. Now, of course, I was then accused of having engaged in dangerous rhetoric, but, you know, buy the book, read it for yourself, and everyone can judge individually whether they think I did or didn't.
What do you teach, or what is it you lecture on?
I teach politics, political science, political philosophy, national security policy.
And your phone number is a D.C. one, so are you in the D.C. area then, or are you in the
Yeah, so the
Michigan?
college is in South Central Michigan, founded mm-hmm. in 1844, has about 1,500 or 1,600 undergraduate students, plus a graduate program, a relatively new graduate program in politics, and that's all in Michigan. But for about a decade, the college has maintained a center here in Washington on Capitol Hill
yeah.
called the Kirby Center for Constitutional Studies. And this campus, it's a building, but it's a little campus, I guess. We have undergraduate students that do semesters in Washington. I teach them, and we do all kinds of other events and seminars and things and speaking events that I work on as well.
Well, that's neat. I imagine then you work with Matt Spaulding. We've had him on this program many times, and I've interviewed him for TV as well.
Matt Spaulding runs the Kirby Center.
Good. Oh, excellent. All right, now here's a quote from your book. "These are dangerous times. The left has made them so and insists on increasing the danger. Leftists hold virtually every commanding height in our society, financial, intellectual, educational, cultural, administrative. And yet, they affect the posture of an oppressed and besieged resistance," end quote.
Yeah.
That's excellent. Yeah. Why don't you unpack that a little bit?
Well, when I say these are dangerous times, I think, you know, I could cite any number of examples, but when I actually wrote those words, what was first and foremost on my mind was the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, in which I ought to be honest, you know, I wasn't particularly impressed by the accuser that the Democrats managed to bring forward. I actually thought, for instance, that the prosecutor from Arizona, whom the Republicans had questioned her, found all sorts of holes, gaps, inconsistencies in her testimony. And in fact, the memo that the prosecutor wrote after that, which was a memo essentially saying if this were a case and she were a witness and my job was to decide whether to bring a prosecution or not, I would have to decline to do so because there isn't enough here. And yet the left just took it on faith. This happened. If you don't believe her, you're bad, you're anti-woman, you're pro-rape, we need to destroy this man. And I thought this is a kind of just craziness. You know, Bill Clinton used to complain about what he called the politics of personal destruction, but nothing thrown at Bill Clinton was like anything thrown at Brett Kavanaugh, and that's before you get to the fact that Bill Clinton was actually guilty of most, if not all, of the things that he was accused of. So it just seemed to me, I didn't feel or see any sort of regret on the part of the left, like maybe this time we've finally gone too far and we need to dial it back. Once they dug into their position and decided to destroy Judge, now Justice Kavanaugh, they would not climb out of those positions, but just hardened their position in every way. Yeah. And I thought, all right, this is just the way it is now. And so the next outrage against somebody will be even worse than this, more irrational, but also more shrilly maintained in the face of contrary evidence or a lack of evidence.
Wow. You know, it's interesting about this story, and this is kind of related in one sense. The Covington kids, and the way they were maligned, especially that one boy in particular.
Oh, for sure.
And now the way this big high-power attorney has been hired by his family, the family of the, you know, the Covington boy in the center of the controversy. And I think good will come out of this big lawsuit, because I even watched a video that the attorney put together. When you watch it, you realize, man, this poor kid, he did nothing wrong. I mean, not even remotely wrong. And yet, you know, Bill Maher and all these different people were just denouncing this kid like, the, you know, he was some racist or something. It was awful.
It was awful. That's a good example of what certainly I meant and had in mind. And, you know, the next meltdown freakout of the leftist media intellectual complex will be worse than the last. That's the one thing you can say with some confidence in our time.
Well, the good thing about this, though, I hope something happens with the lawsuit in the sense that, you know, okay, next time, you know, don't speak out on, you know, judge this poor kid until you know the facts and so forth. How about the story about the Virginia governor? As you and I are recording this discussion, here the Virginia governor is besieged, not because he promoted infanticide, which is what he ought to be ashamed of, but because he did this terrible thing back in 1984 when he was a medical student and he had a photograph of him in blackface and he's clowning around with somebody dressed up like a KKK guy.
Although now, he denies it. I don't even know what to believe there, because he first said he was one of the people in the picture, but he couldn't remember which one. Then a few days went by and he said, no, I'm pretty sure I'm not one of the people.
But
in the picture.
It's on his page, though.
It is on his page. You know. But somebody Tucker Carlson had on last night, a writer from the left, I basically agreed with. And this writer said, look, it's a terrible picture. It's not merely a lapse in judgment. It's pretty grotesque for somebody to even participate in something like that. And then to compound that by making it a public part of your presentation of yourself in a yearbook. But it's 35 years ago, and why are we going to forever define people by one thing that they did? Especially when, you know, others have talked to, including some of Northam's political rivals from other parties, have said, I never got the sense from him that he was any kind of racist or bigot or unfair in any way. He was always personally, above board in all the dealings with him. So the people who know him can't even say that they've seen any sign of a real moral character flaw in this man. I mean, aside from promoting infanticide, which I would call a character flaw.
Yes.
And yet he's still, they're still calling for his head. And very few voices on the left have come out to say, this is going too far. In fact, the guest on Tucker I saw last night is the only one that I know of.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, because it's almost like we're reliving the French Revolution. To the extreme, but...
We don't have guillotines yet, but
right.
we're living that sort of, insistence on ever greater purity, ideological purity. You're sort of with the program, or you're an enemy. And the program changes from day to day to day. So you can be with the program on Monday and think you're fine. And by Friday, the vanguard has decided that we're going to intensify and radicalize what the message really is. And the things that you were saying on Monday are now out of bounds. And so you're out. You're unpersoned. That's the other scary thing. But something that, frankly, was quite common in communist ideologies.
Yeah.
Change the definition of what the party wants, and then you either allow, the people you want to survive, you allow them to quote-unquote catch up, and then, give them a pass because they've changed their opinions on the spot for you. And then the people that you don't want, you don't even give them the chance. You just say, no, you believed the wrong thing. You believed the right thing yesterday, but the wrong thing today. We're not going to give you the chance to change your mind or make atonements. You're just gone.
It's like, it's kind of like 1984, the novel, that is. Okay, we have about a minute left. What would you like to say about President Trump and what he could do to try and help these divided states of America to become more united?
Well, look, it's difficult for him to help, not because he doesn't want to help, but because he will never be given credit or the benefit of the doubt from anybody, any of his opponents, and that includes his so-called conservative opponents, but certainly from his left-wing opponents. So I believe that the basic Trump platform of immigration enforcement, of better trade deals, and a kind of a foreign policy retrenchment or retooling could have helped unify the country economically and politically. But the ruling class, in particular the president's left-wing enemies, are determined not to let him accomplish any of that. And so the program, the tragedy so far of the Trump administration is the massive opposition that he's faced, unlike any president I've ever seen.
Right.
It has so prevented him from implementing an agenda. And he's gotten a lot done. I don't want to take anything away from him. He has gotten a lot done on trade. I think immigration has been much more difficult for him to get things done on. In foreign policy, he has a freer hand, so he's been able to do more there. But certainly, if the times were more normal, if this was more like the early 80s when Reagan got a lot of bipartisan cooperation to implement his program, or even the mid-90s when Clinton got a lot of bipartisan cooperation to implement his program, I think we could have seen We could have seen more unity because we would have seen policies that help a broad majority, but the president's enemies just won't allow that.
Yeah, it's almost like trying to drive a car with the emergency brake on. Listen, thank you so much for being with us. Michael Anton, again, the name of his book is After the Flight 93 Election. Thank you so much for being with us. All the best.
Thank you.